Your Honors, I would start with summarizing very briefly the procedural posture of this case, because it's particularly relevant to the issues before court. First, Mr. Thompson was convicted upon a guilty plea of three charges, what I refer to on brief as the OO conviction, the indecent liberties conviction, a class 5 felony, the O1 conviction, possession of child pornography, a class 6 felony, and the O2 conviction, procuring a minor, a class 5 felony. On June 29, 2017, the Circuit Court entered the sentencing order in which it imposed 10 years with 8 suspended on all of these. And it appears, and that was entered in the June 29th sentencing order. On July 28, 2017, it appears that the Circuit Court conducted a hearing for resentencing on the O1 conviction.
Let me summarize, and maybe we can save everybody some time.
Yes, sir.
And if you disagree.
Okay.
On June 26, 2017, the court had convicted Thompson of indecent liberties and child pornography and sentenced him to 10 years with 8 suspended on each, which exceeded the statutory limit on child pornography, correct?
Yes, John.
On August 10, 1917, he unanimously reduced the indecent to 5 years, 4 months suspended, but didn't address the incorrect sentence for child pornography. So,
yes, Your Honor. Yes, I would point out that I believe that sentencing order was meant to reflect the hearing that took place on July 28th.
Okay. On September 25th, 2017, he correctly reduced the child pornography to 5 years, 4 suspended, and sentenced the defendant to indecent liberties, 10 years, 9 suspended, which was not the original sin. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right. And then on January 23rd, 1919, he corrected again the error and sentenced the defendant to 10 years with 8 suspended, which was the original sentence on indecent liberties. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, I just wanted to get all that out so that we all have the same basis for discussion.
Yes, Your Honor, that is correct. And in that case, I can skip forward to addressing the assignments of error that attack the validity of the September 25th, 2017, and January 23rd, 2019 correction orders, because those orders are valid. As Your Honor noted, the September 2017 correction order was supposed to correct the already erroneous August 10th, 2017 order. That order entered to correct the August order mistakenly provided the sentence, mistakenly stated the sentence again. But the record demonstrates that these were clerical errors. In addition to the attorney's representation to the court at both of the hearings that took place on, for which there were transcripts produced, and the court's own expressed intent. There was no ambiguity in what the court intended the sentence to be. The court intended to reduce the sentence for the possession of child pornography charge to be within a statutorily prescribed range, and that was the 5 years with 4 suspended. The court later remedied the inadvertent mistake in the January 23rd, 2019 order. And so these orders were entered pursuant to the Circuit Court's inherent and statutory authority, pursuant to Code Section 8-428, to correct Scrivener's errors. These mistakes in the August 10th, 2017 and September 25th, 2017 orders resulted from minor mistakes or inadvertence and not from judicial reasons or determination. And that is established by the competent evidence in the record that those orders failed to speak the truth by inadvertently referencing the wrong sentence or conviction. There's no evidence that the court intended to impose a lesser sentence for the OO conviction.
I'm assuming I'm assuming your argument is that 8.01428B allows the court to do that as opposed to Rule 1:1.
Your Honor, and yes, the point is that because those corrections were made to correct clerical errors, that the court had inherent and statutory authority. It always has the authority to correct those errors in order to make its records speak the truth. And as the Supreme Court of Virginia noted in the Jefferson case, often the best way for the court to reconcile an order that does not speak the truth is to enter a later order doing just that. In conclusion, I would submit that this court should find that the first and third assignments of error fail to the extent that they attack the jurisdiction of the court to enter the September 25th, 2017 and January 23rd, 2019 corrections orders, because those orders are valid. And Mr. Thompson should not benefit from a series of clerical errors that the circuit court remedies, all in an effort to effectuate his statutorily permissible sentence for the 01 conviction. I would also point out as to the circuit court's intent that the circuit court even denied Mr. Thompson's request for a sentence reduction. And there was no ambiguity in the court's ruling on that issue. Second, as to these assignments of error, I would submit that Mr. Thompson failed to timely file a notice of appeal from the two corrections orders entered on September 25th, 2017 and January 23rd, 2019, and his appeal therefore should be dismissed. Under Rule 586, the notice of appeal must be filed within 30 days after the entry of the final judgment or other appealable order, and a timely filed notice of appeal is necessary to confer jurisdiction upon the court to hear the appeal. Here, the deadline to file the notice of appeal from the September 25th, 2017 order expired on October 25th, 2017. Similarly, for the January 23rd, 2019 order, it expired on February 22nd, 2019. I would point out that Mr. Thompson's assignments of error flow from the entry of the amended orders themselves and not from the original sentencing order, as he challenges the circuit court's jurisdiction to enter the orders at all. As the Supreme Court noted in Jefferson, the appellant should have been aware that his time to file a notice of appeal was already running, and therefore dismissal under Rule 586 is appropriate. Finally, Your Honors, I submit that Mr. Thompson failed to preserve his double jeopardy arguments and therefore procedurally defaulted under Rule 5A18. He failed to preserve the double jeopardy objections both below in writing and orally before the court at any time in the proceedings below. And he therefore waived his objection and argument on that issue. Additionally, this court should not consider the ends of justice exception. First, Mr. Thompson improperly raised his ends of justice request in his amended brief and not in his original opening brief. He was allowed to file an amended brief because pursuant to Rule 5A20, he needed to identify where in the record his errors were preserved, and they were in fact not preserved. Rule 5A20 requires that the ends of justice request be stated in the opening brief, and he failed to state that request in his opening brief. He added it in his amended brief, and that was a substantive variance that was not permissible under the leave of court that he was granted. This court has noted that it will not consider that request sua sponte, and so Mr. Thompson's failure to properly prevent it from being before the court now. Finally, I would point out that there is no grave injustice or error at issue here. I've conducted that analysis to demonstrate that there was no error and no grave injustice on brief, and I will rely on my brief to that. I would just briefly note that the Nelson case supports the Commonwealth's position that it is not double jeopardy for the court to correct a mistake in a sentence. And in that case, this court recognized the sentencing court's authority to correct itself. That position is also supported by the Lundian case, which is a federal case. I would conclude that the circuit court's intent was clear, and the circuit court never intended to change the 00 conviction to be reduced, and the court was trying to effectuate its ruling that the 01 conviction receive a statutorily permissible range. In conclusion, this court should affirm the judgment of the Chesapeake Circuit Court unless there are any questions from the court.
Hearing none, we thank you. We thank you very much, Ms. Minix. The case is submitted. We